From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters. As we approach the end of the year, the days are short and the nights, they seem to last forever. Well, the team here at Boise State Public Radio is leaning into that darkness to share stories that take place at nighttime and that bring you to spaces that are oftentimes bustling or maybe completely undisturbed after the sun sets. It's a series we're calling After Dark, and we thought, what a better way to begin than by taking you to one of the darkest spots in our state, maybe even the country, and that's the Central Idaho Dark Sky Reserve. Rachel Cohen has the story about one student experiencing it for the very first time.
Jules De La Cruz was studying environmental science at UCLA when she got an assignment to go to Idaho last summer as a light pollution ambassador. She arrived with one other student. Together, they got ready for their first mission.
So it's like 11 p.m. We pack this suitcase, right? It looks like a suitcase from like Deal or No Deal. It's like pretty heavy duty. And inside it has like a tripod. It has a lens. It has the camera. Put that in the trunk. Get like really warm clothing and then drive to whatever location.
The pair hopped into their Toyota Corolla rental and ventured down the back roads. Their task? Snap unobstructed pictures of the night sky.
The overarching goal was just to get the images.
They were stationed in the Central Idaho Dark Sky Reserve, which spans about 1,400 square miles between Ketchum and Stanley. It became the country's first reserve of its kind in 2017. It's so dark you can reportedly see the shadows from the planet Venus. But lights from cities and a nearby mine have the potential to threaten its gold tier status. And the ambassadors were there on a mission funded by NASA and in partnership with Boise State University to document the sources of light pollution. They arrived at their first destination and made sure to park a good distance away so the recent glow from their headlights would be out of sight. They hiked up to a spot with a view and set up their special sky-quality camera with a fisheye lens and a setting for long exposure shots.
You have to make sure that one side of the camera is facing north, so we'd have to like calibrate it each time we took an image and like get a compass from our phone out, put it on the camera, make sure the top of the camera is facing north, and then just crouch down, make sure we're out of the field of view, and like, you know, you would hear like a click when the lens would like first open, and it's just like silent. And then you hear another click, and then that's how you know it's ready.
They stayed out until 1:30 a.m., but this night it was cloudy and their photos didn't come out too well. It actually turned out to be difficult to get these high-quality shots that could detect the light pollution. For two nights, it was rainy. So De La Cruz was still thinking, okay, when are we actually going to see the stars that we came here for?
I grew up in L.A., so having like six different streetlights on at 2 a.m., was normal for me. I didn't really think of night as like this complete darkness. It was more just like time with less lights, but not no lights.
Most people in this country, more than 80%, live in places where light pollution means they can't see the true night sky.
One thing that I was like really anticipating was just that moment of seeing the Milky Way, because again, like that was kind of like one of the selling points of preserving the night sky, right? Like there's the ecology aspect, there's a health aspect, but I think one of the biggest sellers is just the beauty of it.
The first night might have been a letdown, but then the pair planned a two-night expedition near Stanley in one of the more rural places in the reserve.
I just remember being in the middle of this flat field and maybe like a mile away, we're like surrounded by these really tall trees. But because we're in the middle of the field, the lens from the camera just gets this almost perfect 360 of the sky without any like trees covering the circumference.
The lens on the camera sat wide open for a couple of minutes, so enough light could filter in for it to capture the Milky Way. In the meantime, silence.
It was like 1:30 a.m. and it was like freezing, but all you could really do was look up. And you just see this like bright twinkling. And it's like dark, but it's not empty. Being there in this silence, in this darkness, but then being surrounded in the top by this like blanket of twinkling stars. I mean, it seems so like, I don't know, warm, cozy, just, I don't know if the word is like ethereal, but definitely like magical to a certain extent. Yeah.
When the shutter closed, De La Cruz could look at the back of the camera and see what the device could see, which she could not, a brightness she couldn't make out with her own eyes. The wide-angle lens had transformed the 3D scene into a flattened snow globe.
In the ideal image, the background is like a really dark navy, right? And then you have these like speckles, and then you have that like beautiful band of the Milky Way.
Seeing this ideal picture helped her understand the kind of light that was not supposed to be in the frame. The leaders of the Dark Sky Reserve have been worried, anecdotally, about how the growth in Idaho's capital city could be affecting the night sky in one of the most remote places in the state.
In the images where you can really clearly see the influence of Boise, there's like this gradient of like a yellowish kind of greenish haze that surrounds the edges, and it kind of prevents that like contrast between the stars and the Milky Way.
The UCLA students and their professor will start analyzing these fisheye photos early next year. The software they use actually erases all the beauty that De La Cruz saw, the stars and the Milky Way, so it can focus on the unnatural light along the horizon. And that will help them pinpoint the sources of light pollution. More photos year after year can show potential trends. That's why De La Cruz is coming back next summer. Though she says the sky glow of LA is normal for her at this point, and even symbolizes the comfort of a place she loves. She says doing research in the reserve showed her how rare moments of true darkness can be, and she's excited to bring some more light pollution ambassadors along. Rachel Cohen, Boise State Public Radio News.
The music in this piece comes from Poddington Bear. Up next in our After Dark series, we have a kind of spooky story. Many people have experienced unusual phenomena at the Old Idaho Penitentiary in Boise. Some chalk it up to overactive imaginations, but others swear something lingers there. More than 100 people died at the old pen in its 101 years as a prison. Men, women, even children had all stayed there. And it only closed in 1973 after prisoners rioted in calls for better treatment. As part of our After Dark series, reporter Madeline Beck went there at night with a paranormal investigation crew, of course, to learn about possible spirits that may have stuck around.
Nighttime ghost investigations aren't for the faint of heart.
By the way, the door slams.
That's Tina Hughes, who led a group as part of a paranormal investigation at the old penitentiary in Boise. That included members of the public who'd purchased tickets and the group Hughes volunteers for, Big River Paranormal. They lead several groups of investigators through dark buildings with flashlights, occasionally turning them off as everyone stands shoulder to shoulder in musty cells.
We're just here to have a conversation with you, see if you're here, you want to say hi. You want to make a noise for us?
Proceeds from events like this benefit the Idaho Historical Society. Hughes started volunteering for the group about 2.5 years ago after attending one of these events herself. By day, she's an accounting technician for the state of Idaho, and she actually used to be afraid of the dark.
I'm from a small town in Nevada, so we had coyotes, and I was always told, be careful of coyotes.
But now, Hughes leads teams through the old penitentiary at night, pointing to burn marks on walls and ceilings and trying to communicate with those who might have never left. They have gear like cameras, recorders, and devices that measure temperature and electrical currents. She says nighttime is best for these outings.
Things are quieter, so you can hear a lot more of what's going on in the building or what may be going on around you. I mean, you can hear footsteps when you normally wouldn't because during the day, there's a lot of people walking around.
Hughes has had her own experiences there, too.
The gentleman says, oh, it got really warm in here. I'm like, it did. And right about that time, my butt got touched. And I'm like, whoa, okay.
Hughes also listens to hours and hours of audio that's recorded during these investigations, trying to make out any sounds or words that may have been too quiet or unnoticed in person. Tina's group of investigators started their tour in a building where a floodlight was on in the top floor, which was strange.
Hold on, just one second. Weird. Is the light not usually on?
No.
That light later went out by itself. But then there was a metal gate. When we came in, it was closed. We opened it to walk up to the top floor and look at the burn damage and cells there. But when we came back down...
Tara? Did you close the gate?
That gate was closed.
That's crazy. Oh my God.
Other kinds of reported experiences include cold spots, being touched, and hearing voices when people aren't around. Marie Johnston leads Big River Paranormal, and she's quick to note that most spooky experiences at allegedly haunted places are non-ghost related.
Well, you know, 95% of the cases that we go on actually have a logical explanation for the activity. And it's really important for anybody investigating the paranormal to look for those logical explanations before they deem something haunted.
Johnston's team also helps investigate other places, and she says they've handled more than 900 investigations altogether. Big River Paranormal has around 20 people volunteering in Boise and many more in North Idaho and Portland. But Johnston agrees with others in saying that the Old Pen is likely the most haunted place in Idaho.
We've gotten a lot of activity out of here.
Just so visitors know, though, daylight won't protect you from the paranormal.
No, because we're open every day for visitation, and we consistently have people who tell us that they've experienced something or had significant feelings or felt changes.
J.C. Brain works at the Old Pen. He's had his own experiences near the gallows there, including rushes of air and hearing voices when no one was around. Looking at the history of the place, he says even a few people incarcerated there reported hauntings, though it's hard to tell whether they were haunted by ghosts or guilt.
People who were incarcerated reported that they were haunted by either a victim or a partner or someone who they encountered.
Brain explains that the territorial prison started operations in 1872, before Idaho was even a state. Records aren't great, but from what they've found so far, at least 130 people died there.
So that includes 10 executions, and then everything else ranging from murder and suicide to disease and natural causes deaths.
Nighttime paranormal investigations at the Old Pen are on hold for the winter because most don't want to be out in the cold for hours on end. Back with Tina in the group, we heard a potential moaning sound up near Death Row, where the last man was hanged in 1957.
Was that somebody? Did anybody hear like a moan?
Yeah.
And that was nobody.
No.
Luckily, after we heard it a few more times, it seemed to just be the sound of traffic, much to my relief. For Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Madeline Beck.
To check some of the electronic voice phenomena recorded at the Old Pen or anywhere else, you can go to BigRiverParanormal.com. Our After Dark series continues next. For about a century, Earth's nights have been not so dark, because of artificial lighting, from street lights to neon signs, even to car headlights. But Boise State Public Radio is exploring dark spaces in a series we're calling After Dark. So now we're going to check in with a Boise State University professor who's studying how those lighter nights are actually affecting animals and insects, but also what we can do about it.
We know that songbirds will sing longer in light-polluted areas. They'll sing longer into the night. I'm Jesse Barber, and I'm a professor in the Department of Biology at Boise State. My lab tries to understand the natural world through the senses of other animals. So we do a lot of work on light pollution, noise pollution, and basic interactions between organisms. The field of studying the effects of anthropogenic lighting, or light at night, on wildlife is relatively new. Some of the earliest lights were filament-based, mostly a yellow or orange glow. But many of the technologies that allowed these old, warmer lights, mercury vapor, metal halide, they have ultraviolet components that we can't see. And insects have a lot of sensitivity in the ultraviolet, and they're very attracted to it. But the last several years have seen what a lot of people call the LED revolution. And LED lights now give people really fine control over the type of light they're making, but they also make it a lot cheaper, both in, you know, in terms of cost of production and in the amount of energy to run those bulbs. Blue light entrains the circadian cycle in all animals. So it's those wavelengths of light that the brain is using to alter these wake-sleep cycles. And we know that those blue and white lights alter circadian rhythms in animals more, but they also change animal behavior more. Now, in fact, you can make LED lights in warm colors, and more manufacturers are starting to do so. But it's also just as easy to make them very white or even blue, what we would call a high color temperature. We work with a lot of different animals, bats, insects, songbirds. Sometimes we work with raptors, mice. Most of it focuses on echolocating bats that hunt insects and the insects themselves, with a special emphasis on moths. Bats are a great model for understanding nocturnal wildlife, how light pollution, for instance, affects vertebrates, and then moths, who are also strongly affected by light, they're attracted to light. So really, we wish we could understand how all wildlife is impacted by light pollution, for example, but bats and moths are really good model organisms. Some bats avoid light, and so where streetlights are, it's lost habitat. Even if there's good habitat, there's good forest, other vegetation, insects, those bats aren't going to hunt there because of those lights. And then there's a whole other group of bats that most people think of when they think of streetlights that are attracted to lights, that fly to the light. But why do they come to the streetlight? Are they attracted to it in the same way a moth is? No, they're coming to the light to hunt because of the smorgasbord of insects that are attracted for what appear to be some sort of innate reason. So regardless of the reason, they find themselves vulnerable to bat predators. They find themselves a long way from the host plants they need to lay their eggs on for the next generation. And in the morning, after they've not been able to leave that area, they find themselves on the wall of a gas station, no longer against their natural camouflage, available to bird predators. And those reasons might be why a couple of different research groups have now shown that at a small scale, lights appear to drive insect declines. And insect declines are worrying because they underpin all terrestrial food webs. If the bugs go away, we go away. Red light is not very visible to animals. So bats can see it, but not very well. And many insects aren't even receptive to red light. So we have a project in Grand Teton National Park where we converted all of the streetlights in the largest infrastructure in the park to experimental lights that let us switch from red to white and change the intensity. And so we're attempting to see if, when the lights are red, are we not attracting the bats that we used to? Are we not pushing the bats away that the white lights used to? And are insects less attracted to this red light? They're LED, and they're specifically made to attempt to mitigate the effects of light pollution on wildlife. The basic punchline is that they work pretty well. Fewer insects are attracted, and the bat community acts more like it would in darkness. Because essentially, we're trying to rewild the night sky, to return it to darkness, and allow people to have the light that they at least feel like they need. Controlling lights and mitigating light pollution is something that not only is really tractable, you can turn off a light, you can change a bulb. The amazing thing about mitigating light pollution is we can do something right now that will make the world more resilient to all the other assaults that humankind is putting upon it.
That was Boise State University biology professor Jesse Barber. This story was produced by Sasha Woodruff. For more on how you can cut down on unnecessary lighting, just go to our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Okay, now let's head to one of the Treasure Valley's top bakeries. That's right. You heard me right. Acme Bake Shop, first fired up its oven 10 years ago, and it's been distributing its loaves to retail stores and restaurants all around the area ever since then. However, to ensure that the bread is at its peak freshness before heading to market, founder and chief baker Michael Runswald starts his day in the early morning hours. James Dawson recently stopped by Acme, and he brings us this story.
All right, so it is just about 11 p.m., and I am at an undisclosed location in Garden City, ready to see what's going on with Acme Bake Shop.
How's it going, Mike?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well.
Michael Runswold welcomes me in through a front door with cracked glass spidering out from some kind of impact. An Acme Bake Shop sticker acts like a patch over the crystallized wound. He's already been at the shop since about 10:30 p.m., which isn't when he usually clocks in.
Typically start my workday at around 2 a.m., before maybe. But Fridays, there's just more stuff that needs to be baked, so it takes a few more hours.
Pistachio croissants are about to come out of the oven, and in their place go their ham and Gouda stuffed cousins.
Right, so making sure we get as much cheese as possible in these croissants.
Proofing cabinets filled with different doughs and pastries line up next to a massive oven that holds four separate chambers with their own temperature and steam controls. Soon, Michael's pulling out perfectly golden brown loaves of potato bread from the oven with a paddle that's at least twice as long as he is. Tunes pumped in courtesy of Radio Boise echo off the concrete walls, which, like pretty much everything in the bakery, have a layer of flour coating them. Michael soon begins slapping out dough on a nearby stainless steel table to prep them for a final proof before they go into the oven. He also loads a tub of delicious-smelling orange dough, destined to become turmeric baguettes, into a machine that will divide it into even pieces. All of this happens well before the clock even hits midnight. That's when Michael stops taking restaurant orders for the day and figures out his game plan for how to stack the oven over a few smoke breaks he takes sitting on a milk crate.
One of those filthy habits that kind of comes with the job.
He has to figure out the most efficient way to bake roughly 2,900 items over the next few hours, including hundreds of baguettes that can't all fit at once. He'll soon solve that Tetris puzzle and move on to the next batch.
Okay. Now, can we do focaccia in one batch? Just. I would be talking to myself like this if you weren't here. All right, I think I'm being summoned.
For the rest of the night, Michael's schedule will be dictated by his timers, freeing up his brain to calculate the next move in a precisely orchestrated dance that becomes even more complicated as staff show up around 2 a.m. Ingredients for the morning's regular baguettes are mixed together and left to rise while dough for future bakes are created. Another batch of bakers arrives around 3 and gets to work slicing the now cooled loaves of bread, but only after Michael has to spend a quick 5 minutes realigning the machine's blades. Eventually, nearly the entire staff starts pounding out focaccia and shaping baguettes. This is when Michael is nearly glued to the oven, always just a few trays ahead of what his co-workers are cranking out to fill up the nearby proofing cabinets. After loading dozens of loaves at a time on a cloth sliding machine, he's got to clean out the excess flour from each bake. Michael repeats this process for the next several hours, passing off finished loaves to drivers who arrive around 5 a.m. One of them doesn't show up or answer his phone, leaving Michael to cap off his shift with a delivery route he hadn't planned for. No-call no-shows happen every week or two, which he chalks up to the early hours. In the meantime, the other drivers load trays into vans backed up to the dock, ready to be delivered. Finally, sometime in the 7 o'clock hour, Michael gets to breathe a little, even though the air is obscured by a light haze of flour. He rates the shift as a good one with no big hiccups, but he doesn't spend any time romanticizing what he's just done for the last 9 hours.
You know, the sense of accomplishment is as ephemeral as the bread. It's just gonna, this is all gonna be gone in a couple hours. And then we'll do it again.
Well, he'll do it again. I'm going to sleep. Reporting from my bed, James Dawson, Boise State Public Radio News.
Our series After Dark continues right after this. You know, during these short days, the nights are getting colder. I'm sure you've noticed that. Well, in this installment of our After Dark series, Julie Lucata visits the Interfaith Sanctuary Shelter as guests get ready for the night. And just a note here, we are only using first names for the people who are staying at the shelter.
It's 7 p.m. on a Thursday in December. Downtown Boise has been quieted by snow and the winter darkness. Outside the shelter, the city streets are sparse, but cars whiz by on the freeway running parallel to the building.
Interfaith Sanctuary.
Indoors, guests are hanging out in the common room under fluorescent lighting. Folks are microwaving food, spaghetti and bread rolls, and chatting while a movie plays on a TV mounted to the wall. People's stuff is piled in big plastic bags by the staff desk. The temperatures are in the 20s, but inside, it's warm and lively.
Sherry, I'm going to throw hands with you, girl.
Get over here, shirt stuff.
Jaden is grabbing rubber gloves and disinfecting wipes from the maintenance cart for her nightly chores.
Mine's the bathroom, just wiping it down. So that's just basically what I do daily to kind of do my part.
She's a long-term guest at the shelter and has been there almost a year.
My nighttime routine is I basically get my sleeping med in me, and then I'll go out and I'll smoke. I do use the vape, so it's been like calming to me to kind of go out and like just kind of watch the cars go by.
Jaden is enrolled in Project Wellbeing, a program that gives her a bed at Interfaith for as long as she goes to groups, follows curfew, and other shelter rules. Participants get to stay in a separate wing away from the main area where short-term guests normally sleep. The program side is quieter and feels more like a home, one that has a lot of roommates. There are couches, a small aquarium, an art room, and a table full of indoor plants warming under UV lights. Unlike other guests, program participants don't have to leave every morning and can stay at the shelter during the day.
I've got so much more empathy now, I would say, for people experiencing the mental health crisis, like or just not having the financial ability to pay for housing.
When Jaden used to walk by people on the streets before she experienced homelessness, she didn't think about the logistics of making it day by day, night by night.
There really is a day and night life that's different than people who are housed. So I didn't used to think like homeless people could be patient or that it's actually work. A lot of the time of the homeless is spent waiting, like waiting to get inside to go in and check in, waiting to go get your bunk ready or your bed, your floor spot.
Jaden first experienced instability when her family lost their home during the 2008 housing crisis. A few years later, she ended up sleeping outside, going in and out of hospitals until she got her long-term spot at the shelter.
I've been doing coffee with my sister every Wednesday. So we've been reconnecting and rebonding, kind of like getting that time together that we didn't get when I was using. So it's been really good.
Because it gets dark so early, the shelter feels extra cozy to Jaden this time of the year.
to be honest. It's pretty peaceful for me, from what I've noticed. It helps me kind of gear down my mind, and I don't know. It's quiet. It's serene, kind of.
Does this place feel like a home to you?
It does. It absolutely does.
Not everyone at the shelter feels this way. On a smoke break outside, Jaden is joined by Hipsy and Molly.
No, it's constantly full of chaos.
That's very accurate. Like, I also feel like there's a lack of peace here. Whether you're dealing with your own stuff or just other people kind of having issues with each other, you try and stay out of it, but it's not often quiet here until, like, 2 in the morning when everyone else is asleep.
No, I got you. Doran, wherever you are, you're good. Kevin, can you do a top bunk? Okay. I'm going to put you in number 5, okay?
Back in the main room, staff member Terrence Scherer Jr. is doing roll call and assigning bunks to the people on the wait list for the night. It's 8 o'clock, one more hour until lights out.
I think I'll have room for everyone tonight, so that's a good thing.
What you said bunk number 17? There's some blankets there.
You can just pull all of it off, and I can give you a bag so we can put it in, and then we'll take it to the laundry room and have it washed.
Do they still have a warming shelter for tomorrow?
The shelter can be chaotic, but Jaden says the night is one of the few times when people experiencing homelessness can escape the constant judgment of the outside world.
We're not experiencing that sort of like fishbowl sensation of being kind of seen and watched from the corner of their eyes, the vehicle, or wherever they are. That's the feeling of the nighttime rather than the daytime, because we're not being observed, I would say.
By 9, the lights are dimmed and things slow down. Jaden goes to bed in the dorm room she shares with other women in the program. She sleeps in one of the top bunks.
It's usually just kind of dark and not dreary. It's just like everyone's played for the day and we're all like calming down, getting ready for bed.
In the morning, Jaden will journal and attend a meditation group. Folks on the other side of the shelter will wake up sometime around 6, do chores, pack up, and leave the space by 7, looking for a warm place to stay for the day. At 5 p.m., the doors will open again to provide another night of shelter for those seeking refuge from the dark. Julie Luqueta, Boise State Public Radio News.
As we continue our After Dark reporting series, we're headed to eastern Idaho, where hundreds of thousands of bats leave the comfort of their roosts to hunt and to pollinate under the cover of dark. But as Troy Oppie explains, they aren't alone. Researchers are watching too.
Thousands of bats flying en masse probably don't make as much noise as you might expect, at least not that humans can hear.
20 to like 50 kilohertz is about the range that bats are operating in. 20 is definitely the higher spectrum of human hearing.
That's Mauro Hernandez, a bat researcher with Oregon State University, working at Craters of the Moon National Monument in Idaho. Its isolated caves are perfect bat habitat to study the often unseen species critical to pest control and pollination. Using special microphones, researchers can record bats' sonar emissions. The animals use sound to navigate and see what's around them in total darkness.
So I use a special software, and it actually allows me to see the calls and the waveforms of these bat calls as they echolocate. So I'm able to see what they're seeing.
The sounds can be converted into the human hearing range, too. This recording is slowed down.
And then as they approach something that is a lot closer, whether it is a moth flying around or maybe it's a tight entrance to a cave, they use what's called a feeding buzz. So that's where they're rapidly sending out these calls. So the information comes back rapidly, so they're not crashing into walls, into each other.
Around 14 different bat species call Idaho home. Places like Boise were likely once prime roosts, says Boise State Professor of Biology Jesse Barber.
Along the river that runs through the middle of the city was undoubtedly amazing bat habitat before people settled here. Now it's quite rare to see bats even along what appears to be a natural dream in the middle of a major city.
No one likes mosquitoes more than bats. The summer pests are their primary food source. Hernandez says what we don't know about bats greatly outweighs what we do. For example, we don't even know how many hundreds of thousands of bats live in the state. His work includes using infrared cameras to try to observe and count bats and special nets when capturing a bat for study is necessary, but he tries to keep his distance.
Also, stress is a big thing with bats, so that's one part of the job that we do at night.
And bats do give clues once they know folks are nearby.
They start getting a little more animated and start making noise during the daytime. They do make noises that we can hear. It's not echolocation, that's just, vocalizing. That's a helpful indication to back off.
Hernandez says another reason to keep his distance is to limit potential spread of a dangerous fungus discovered only about 13 years ago, which leads to what's called white nose syndrome. It dissolves bats' skin and wing membranes and thrives in cold temperatures.
It disturbs bats when they're hibernating, causes them to wake at odd hours during hibernation, using up their fat reserves, using up their water sources.
The fungus was originally found in New York and has been identified in southeast Idaho already, but white nose syndrome isn't widespread here yet. Wind energy is another threat to bats. The air pressure as turbines spin can cause internal hemorrhaging. Our feline friends contribute to bat depredation too. Bats dying off may not seem concerning, as they're often blamed for spreading disease. Hernandez says their potential role in the COVID-19 pandemic has made bats even more hated.
I try to, remove that anger towards bats, right? Because it's very easy to sort of point the blame and then not care about them and not feel like we need to help conserve and protect them.
Without bats, we humans would probably have a lot more mosquito bites. And because bats are the main pollinator for the agave plants, tequila and mezcal would probably be more scarce. But most of that work happens after dark and we don't see it. Hernandez, who's been studying bats since his early college years, says we should be paying more attention.
In the state of Idaho, our little brown bat is likely going to be listed federally as an endangered species. And now it looks like we have to step in a way to try and conserve and protect the species.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is evaluating potential endangered species protections for the little brown bat. Troy Oppie, Boise State Public Radio News.
And we'll wrap up our After Dark series right after this. The team here at Boise State Public Radio has been sharing stories that take place at nighttime, and we've been bringing you to spaces that are bustling, but also spaces that are undisturbed after the sun sets. So we want to wrap up our After Dark series with Morning Edition host George Prentice with a very special trip to the Boise Airport.
We are curbside at the Boise Airport, and boy, is it cold, and wow, is it late. The last arriving flights have landed. Passengers are grabbing their bags and running for the arms of their loved ones. Upstairs at the ticket counter, it's pretty quiet, except at Delta, there's one more flight to Atlanta. It leaves at midnight. Yep, it's the red eye. So let's head upstairs to the ticket counter through security and over to the gate. As tonight becomes tomorrow morning. Boy, is it cold.
My name is Jim Moore. I'm the station manager for Delta Airlines in Boise, Idaho.
Can I assume that you're as busy as anybody around the holidays? If not more.
I would like to think we're the busiest. Yes, we are. We are busy.
And did you need kind of boarding passes?
Yeah, I probably should.
So my name is Brad Birkenbein. I'm a supervisory transportation security officer. So I'm a supervisor over a variety of different functions on the screening checkpoint. Over the screening staff that actually directly helps the passengers as they navigate through the process over to get to the airplane.
Well, let's talk logistics here. We have a red-eye flight that's about to take off. This is a kind of a bit of a standalone, right? It's the only flight. It has a pretty wide berth,
yes.
Right? Before and after.
Yes, it does. So right now, this flight is a flight that's kind of a little removed from some of the other scheduled flights of the day. It's been a really good attribute to kind of expand the airport's footprint, get people out to one of the busiest airport in the world, I think, Atlanta, right? It gives up people the option to do, most people that come through to that flight actually are connecting to other flights to go goodness knows where throughout the world.
And where's your final destination?
Virginia Beach.
Orlando, Florida. We're visiting my sister and the new baby.
How are you feeling about taking an all-night flight?
Good.
What time do you usually go to bed?
About 10.
No. He goes to bed at about 9.
Okay. And what time do you usually go to bed?
9:30, 45-ish.
So do you have a strategy?
Other than the candy and trying to make them sleep, no.
Okay. Have lots of fun. Don't disturb the other passengers, and we'll sleep when we get there.
Where your final destination is?
Fort Benning, Georgia.
What's south of Fort Benning?
My husband.
Excellent. Can I ask when's the last time you saw him?
It's been a while. May, when we got married.
I'm Tyler.
Blakesley.
Christine.
What's your final destination?
Puerto Escondido in Mexico.
Hello. For the holiday?
Yep.
To Charlotte, North Carolina.
And where are you headed?
Myrtle Beach.
So can I get your first name?
My name is Linda.
And where's your final destination?
Morgantown, West Virginia.
And your final destination is?
Miami. We actually weren't on this flight. Our flight was delayed.
So this was not by choice?
No. So we've been waiting here since, well, our flight was due out at 3 o'clock today.
Are you okay? I mean, you're heading home, right?
No.
Are you going on?
Idaho.
We're heading, from Twin Falls, we're heading to Miami to go on a cruise.
Are you going to make your cruise?
Yes, it's Sunday, thank God.
Okay. Where's your final destination? Where are you heading?
Ohio.
Where in Ohio?
Cleveland.
So you're going from Atlanta and then up to Cleveland?
Yeah.
Has anyone given you advice on what to do, on how to get some sleep or anything? Can you sleep on a plane?
Well, kind of, sometimes. It's a little hard, but you got to make do. Yeah.
Do you have a pillow?
No.
Okay, grab a pillow. So, thank you. And where's your final destination?
D.C.
Are you heading home, or are you going there for the holiday?
Just hanging out. Yeah.
Have you ever done a red eye?
No.
Can you sleep on a plane?
Sure.
So you seem to be very chill with this.
Yeah, I'm just there.
My name is Ellie, and I've been with Delta for 13 years.
My name is Monica, and I've been with Delta for almost 2 years.
My name is Shayna. I've been with Delta for 13 years.
So you must get an interesting mix of people on this flight.
I mean, they're sleepy, sure. Yeah, I mean, they're kind of like our regular passengers that we get in the afternoon. Just a little bit more tired, that's all.
With pillows.
Yeah.
With pillows.
Yeah.
What's interesting about working the late shift?
I like when I see that they've been having a little bit too much fun at the bar, and it's the end of the day for them. You know, and sometimes I get worried, sometimes I get jealous. You know, it's a little bit of everything.
Okay, this is the end of your day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, you ready to button it up?
I hope so.
We did. Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very kind of you.
Yes.
Delta Flight 2077, service to Atlanta, is now boarding through gate B22. All ticket and confirmed passengers, please make your way to gate B22 yes. For departure.
Okay.
And that was our very own Morning Edition host, George Prentice, at the Boise Airport, wrapping up our After Dark series. Now, you can find all the After Dark stories, including pictures of some of the places that we visited, on our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.